Today is October 14th, 2008. The place is Amelia Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida, 32034. This interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Lawrence Carastro. He was born on September 5th, 1921 in Tampa, Florida. My name is Gerhard Tam, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Also attending this interview are the following individuals: Jean Costero, Lawrence's wife, and Connie Darby, his daughter. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. May I call you Larry?
Yes, please.
That's good. Okay, Larry, tell us a little bit about, just briefly, what you did before you enlisted in the Air Force.
I worked at MacDill Field in Tampa, Florida, and I was happy there because they had B-17s there, my ideal airplane. I'd never been on one, so I was able to look at them, but I never got into them. Then, of course, when Pearl Harbor came out, they lowered the qualifications to be a flying cadet. Well, that was my idea. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. So they lowered the qualification to high school graduates, so therefore I ran to the post office, and I enlisted. They gave me all the papers, and even though it was wartime, they say that you need the parent's signature because I wasn't 21 yet. So I go home with my papers, and I go to my mom, and I said, Mom, you know, I've registered for the draft. Pretty soon I'm going to be drafted, and I've gone and enlisted in the Air Force. I want to be a fighter pilot in the airplane. And my mom looked at me and says, are you crazy? I said, well, Mom, I said, they're going to draft me anyway, and I'll be on the ground. She said, yeah, but at least on the ground, you're on the ground. I said, up in the air, that's another strike against you. So go back to the post office and say, well, when will you be 21? I said, it's in a couple of weeks. So he says, come back in a couple of weeks. So that's what I did. I came back. They got me in. They could not draft me because already I was in the reserves at the Air Force, and they said there'll be anywhere from weeks to months before your papers will come in. Well, it took 6 months for my papers to come in. And, of course, working at MacDill, and they're looking at me, why aren't you in the service? I said, you're probably 4F. You know what 4F is, incapable for military duty. I said, no, I'm in the reserve. So finally it came in one day, and I went to, my orders came to go to San Antonio, Texas. I says, hot dog, I'm going to see the Alamo. So we got there, and I got started being processed as a flying cadet, and all the tests, the physical tests, the mental tests, and then the last thing was the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist is supposed to be a doctor of the mind. This is the way they explained it to us. So my interview, it was a personal interview. And when I got through with the psychiatrist, he says, I'm going to have to GDO you. I says, why? I says, GDO means ground duty only. I says, why? He said, well, you're not fit to fly combat. I said, oh. So I went back and I found out the whole barracks had been washed out because even though it was wartime, you had to volunteer to either fly or do submarine duty. So they figured, well, they had all these cadets. They had too many cadets, and they were building the bomber force. So the whole barracks got washed out, and that made me feel a little better. So from there, we went to Shepherd Field, Texas, and got reclassified as a gunner.
What date was that about?
Now, I entered the service in March 6th of 1943. I enlisted in November of 42, but it took 6 months to get in, so it was March 6th of 1943. My orders finally came in, so at the classification center, I guess I was there maybe 2 or 3 weeks when I finally got the news that I wasn't fit for combat duty, as a psychiatrist said. I'd like to have him along on some of my missions. So we went to the Shepherd Field and got reclassified. I said, what are we doing here? I said, you're going to take the test to be a gunner. I said, oh, terrific. So the whole bunch of us, there was a whole barracks, We stayed there a couple of weeks, then they sent us to Laredo, Texas, where we're going to take gunnery. I was there for 2 months. In the meantime, I wrote back and told Mom, I said, well, your wishes have come true. I'm on the ground, and I guess that's where I'll be. But when I got reclassified, I didn't tell her until that the course was completed at Laredo, Texas. It was a 2 month course as a gunner.
Now, let me ask you, what did this training consist of?
The training consisted of we had aircraft recognition. The funny thing was, I was trained to be on a B-24 and sent to the Pacific, and it ended up I was in a B-17 in Europe. So we had classroom, and in classroom we had aircraft recognition of the Japanese planes, and they had a makeup of a turret there and how to operate the turret. And then, of course, we had trap shooting, shotguns when these clay pigeons come out. And then the last week was up in the air. There was in an AT-6, and there was four of us in a group, and each one of us had there was a 30 caliber machine gun on the back of the AT-6 on a horseshoe thing. And we're supposed to shoot at the target, and of course the bullets we got, the bullet tips were colored so we know how many hits we had into the target. So before we took off, the pilot says, now this is the maneuvers I'm going to do. I'm going to go up above the target and come down. I'm going to come be down. I'm going to come up. And in the meantime, whenever the target, the sleeve is in sight, you go ahead and start shooting. So we used up the rounds of ammunition, and this way they knew how many hits we made into the sleeve. So then the day of graduation came, and it's an outdoor graduation on a stage, and our commanding officer called us by name, and as he called our name, we went forth, and he presented my gunner wings. That was a great day for me. I says, hot dog, I'm back up in the air again. So after we got through, I rode home and told Mom, I says, well, Mom, I says, I don't know how you're going to take this. And I bought an extra set of wings, and I mailed it with a letter. It was an 8-page letter and told her all about my training. And I said, I'm back up in the air, and I hope you'll bear with me. Well, one of my brothers was home after I went home on furlough. He said, you should have never sent that letter home. I said, why? He said, because Mom broke down. I said, well, it's just one of the unfortunate things. So from there, they told us we were supposed to start gathering with a group that was supposed to go as a group overseas on a B-17. We would train as a group and everything, but instead, all of that was eliminated from San Antonio, Texas. We were sent to Salt Lake City, Utah. So we pull in there and says, well, where are the airplanes? Says, there's no airplanes here. You're going to take ground training. And that's where I stayed for about 3 weeks, ground training, a pack on our back and a rifle on our shoulders. So then they were going to send us overseas. Now this was, I got in March. Now this is already in the month of June. And he said, you're going to be training to go overseas. I said, gee, that's fine. What happened to the crew we're supposed to? He said, well, that's some way or another, you're here and this is what I'm supposed to do with you. And they were not going, and we found out they was going to send us overseas. They were not going to give us a furlough. Well, one of the guys in our group, his aunt was with the Red Cross. He contacted her, told her what the situation was, and the Red Cross did arrange for us to have a furlough before we go overseas. So they gave us 10 days and 1 day traveling time from Salt Lake City down to Tampa, Florida. It took me 4 days and 4 nights to go there, and then another 4 days and 4 nights to go back, so I had about 3 days at home. So while I was home, I met one of my buddies. He was involved over in the Pacific on Guadalcanal, one of the islands in the Pacific. And this is the day that I was supposed to go back. He said, let's go nightclubbing. I said, well, gee, I've got to leave tonight to go back to Salt Lake City. So I says, I know what I'll do. I'll send a Western Union to the CEO and tell him I'm sick. So my dad had a business downtown in Tampa. He'd been there since 1902, a shoe repair shop. So he knew all the doctors and the lawyers and the judges and everybody else. And this one lawyer who was called into the service as a provost marshal, I think. And my dad went over to him and told him what his son was planning to do. So he says, let me speak to your son. So he called me over there. He says, I know how you feel. He says, but if you do that, he says, they're very familiar with this excuse you're going to give, and it's best you don't do that. So my dad says, son, go. So that night, I left. There's my parents, you know, my mom, tears running down, shaking. They were, goodbye. I said, I'll see you later. So went back to Salt Lake City, and from Salt Lake City, they took us to Orangeburg, New Jersey. It looked like the military went in and took the whole community, like row houses for barracks. And we're supposed to be there 2 or 3 days and be on, put on a ship and go overseas. Now, this is the month of August of 43. They're going real fast. No crews, no 17, nothing. So we, the day came and said, now, of course, he said, we're going to take you by transportation over to the port of New York. You're going to board a ship, and the ship may stay on the dock 1 or 2 days until they get a convoy set up. So he says, when we go there, and before you board, he says, there's going to be someone there with your name, and when he gives your name, you come forth and you give your service number. So, fine. I still remember my service number, 14136149. So I patted the ground a couple of times, stepped on the gangplank, and the border went. So we were in the ship a couple of days, and then the ship started moving up one early morning, and it was all foggy, and I wanted to see the Statue of Liberty. And it was all foggy, and I was up on the deck, and I looked, and the fog finally dissipated, and I saw the Statue of Liberty. I saluted, and I said, I hope to see you again. So the ship, and we pulled out of the harbor, and going to convoy, there must have been, 20, 25, 30 ships in the convoy. And there were destroyers constantly going around us to discourage the submarines. We was on board ship for 12 days, and there was enough of us on board where half of us would be sleeping downstairs and the other half would be upstairs on the deck. And every 12 hours, we would shift. The ones that were downstairs would come upstairs. So the ones that were upstairs would come downstairs. So we was 12 days on board ship. Finally landed at Oran, North Africa. Still no airplane. So we found out it was in a replacement pool. So I stayed at Oran, about a week. And we had outdoor kitchens. And the one thing I remember about Oran, an outdoor kitchen, there must have been flies by the thousands. With one hand, we're shooing the flies away, and the other hand, we're trying to eat. So finally, from Oran, they took us by convoy to Tunis, North Africa. And that's when I joined the outfit. And I says, I'm here. When will I start flying? They said, well, whenever there's a position open. So finally, after being there for about a week, one of the guys on this particular crew couldn't take anymore, and he went AWOL. So they came to me and said, we have a position open. Do you want to fly? I said, that's what I came for.
What organization was it?
Now, this was the second. It's the 15th Air Force. It was stationed in Tunis, North Africa at the time. The 15th Air Force, the second bomb group, one of the oldest bomb groups in the Air Force, and the 49th Squadron. I said, terrific. So I got on the crew. There's no training at all or anything. Well, of course, I'll go back some when going through gunnery school. They taught us how to shoot a 50 caliber machine gun, and we shot at a target and everything like that. So now this is the first time I ever got into a B-17. I met the guys on the crew, very nice guys. And so in the meantime, they're moving from North Africa into southern Italy because they have chased the Germans north. So each crew, or the crew, all gunners slept together. There were six of us in a tent. And this is the picture of my sleeping accommodation. There were six, the gunners would sleep together, and the officers, which was four of them, they would be in a tent of their own. So we were moving, so each crew was responsible for taking care of their tent, loading it up, putting it on the airplane, and flying over to Foggia, Italy.
You took the whole thing on your own aircraft. Everything that you had, the tent
and in the B-17. Yeah, we loaded everything up, and I still haven't met my pilot. Things were moving fast. So it's so the day we had the plane all loaded up, had the B-17 all loaded up, and finally here comes the pilot, and he reminded me of Gary Cooper because he was tall like him. Well, this is the picture of the crew.
We'll take that and scan it and give it back to you.
So this is the first time I met him. So I met him, and then one of the gunners saying, "You know," he said, "I don't think you'll be able to take this airplane off." Said, "Look at everything we've got here in the airplane." So we had the waist door, the waist panel flipped open, and he looked in there, and he said, "No problem." And just the way he said that, I said, "Terrific. He sounds like a good pilot."
You recall his name?
His name is Andrew Cooper. I think his first Andrew. Adrian Cooper.
Adrian, okay.
And you know, he didn't require any type of military courtesy or anything. Of course, we respected him as a pilot, but we were all one family. So we loaded up and crossed the Mediterranean and landed in Foggia, Italy. There were no problems at all, no German Luftwaffe around. So we landed there, and unloaded, and set up a tent. And then the 1st of December of 1943. So finally, it was going to go on the first mission. December, I think, 12th, we're going to bomb an air base across the Adriatic Sea over in Greece. So that was my first mission. So time came to take off, and we took off, and we got over the target, and of course here comes the fighter planes, and this is my first encounter. So whenever the plane pointed their nose at us, we open up. I don't think I ever shot any down, but I sure did put a lot of lead out there. So we made that mission, and then the month, I think we flew two, three, or four more missions in the month of December. Then the month of January came, and it was beautiful weather because the weather had a lot to do with the missions and where we're going. So the month of January, of the 31 days, I think I flew 28 days. So there was a thing that when you complete 50 missions, they would send you, I think, back to the States, or they'd send you for R&R, rest and rehabilitation. So I said, "Oh, gee, this is terrific. You know, I've already got 25 missions this month. And next month," I said, I'll be on R&R for a while. Well, when the month of February started, it was bad. It was like turning the page in a book. The bad weather came in, and we were supposed to fly, and we can't fly because the weather was bad. There was bad weather over the target. And then my final mission, my 35th mission, they made an amphibious landing at Anzio Beachhead. And when they made the landing there, they took the Germans completely by surprise. And so they landed there, and the commanding general thought it was a trap. He told the troops to dig in at the beach. "We're not going anywhere until we find out where these Germans are." And there was no opposition, so they dug in at the beach, and a couple of the guys, I understand, jumped in a Jeep and went all the way up to Rome, 20 miles away, come back and told the officer, "There's no Germans around." But he said, "We're still going to stick here." But now, when the Germans found out what we did, here they came with their panzer unit and just overwhelmed our troops. And the weather got bad. They could not get ammunition. They could not get reinforcement. They couldn't get anything. And the Germans were ready to push them back into the sea. So they had to put everything, and of course the weather was bad, and we couldn't give them any help. So finally, we're supposed to fly. This is my last mission, February 17th, 1944. We were supposed to fly two missions that day. We got up early that morning. We went to breakfast, went out to the plane, and because the weather was bad, they told us, "Stand by." So the officers were up in the front of the airplane, and us gunners, we're back there in the waist, and we're socializing. And we knew the guys in the orderly room. So a couple of the guys came, and we were all socializing, waiting for the moment to go. And we almost talked those guys from the orderly room to come along for a ride. And they were almost going to do it, but at the last minute they backed. Finally, after about, I think, a couple of hours, they finally told us the word had come to go. So the guys at the orderly room said, "I don't think we better go." It's a good thing. It had been a last ride for them. So we finally took off. It was about 2 hours. We originally were supposed to do two missions. We were going to come back, reload, and go back again. And normally at a B-17, we fly from 18 to 26,000 feet. But because we were going to give ground support, they put us at 12,000 feet because we was going to bomb only 3 miles into enemy territory. That was my shortest mission, 3 miles into enemy territory. We were going to bomb the front lines. We were carrying fragmentation bombs. And we took off, formed the formation. And we finally were approaching the target. And as we were approaching the target, the flak came up. I don't recall any fight. It was all flak. And I believe we were leading the squadron. And the flak started getting closer and closer. And when you can smell the exploding smoke through your oxygen mask, you know it was close. And of course, every time it's close, the plane would shake, and it sounded like you were in a tin building because the exploding shells would rain down on the plane like rocks on a tin roof. And then finally, we got one hit and the whole plane just shook, you know, and I'm telling you, everything was coming on the right side. And I was on the left side. I was flying left waist. And our bomb bay doors were open. It was a 3-minute bomb run. In other words, once we're on the bomb run, there's no evasive action, no left, right, up, or down anything. And of course, not using any evasive action, they had us pinned in and they got closer and closer. Finally, we got that one hit, and that whole plane shook, and I'm telling myself, wow, that was pretty close. And I just happened to turn around, and I saw the right waist gunner going for the door. So I said, uh-oh, I'm telling myself, uh-oh, he saw something I should have seen. So the B-17 door, the door opens against the slipstream, and you have to pull the pins and kick the door and go out. Well, the ends of the pins, they were welded with a cable, and it came to a wooden handle, and you grab that wooden handle, and you pull the pins, you kick the door, and out you go. So he tried to pull it, and he turned around to me like this. So immediately, I shoved him aside, and just as soon as I touched that handle, the ship went into a dive, because we got a hit in the cockpit, one in the wing, and one in the tail. And so just as soon as I touched that thing, the right wing started folding up. And, of course, all the lift was on the left side, and the plane fell over on that side. It threw both of us up against the cabin of the plane, and down we were going. And the wind sounded like it was going 1,000 miles an hour, because I've seen some movies where a plane falling through the sky and the wind just whistling like thousands. Well, this is what it sounded like, and down it was going. So, you know, I can remember to this day that my thought was, I better get out of this airplane, because if I'm in it, when it hit the ground, I won't be in very good shape. And for some reason or another, I don't know, it sort of leveled out some. And when it did, I looked over to my right, and I saw daylight. The tail was starting to break off, and it was all jagged. So the right waist gunner, he was about 10 feet away from it. So he's looking at me, his eyes as big as marble, and he's frozen. So I motioned to him to go, go. So he crawled over there, and he fell through the hole. So now I'm on my back, and some of the equipment in the cabin was gathered under one of my feet, and I kicked it loose, and I crawled over there on my back. I put my hand on that ripcord. We had chest chutes. Put my hand on that ripcord because I wanted to be sure I had the right equipment to deploy the parachute. Crawled over to the hole and fell out, and I didn't count to 10 like they say you're supposed to, because I knew we're flying at 12,000 feet, and I don't know how far we fell. I must be close to the ground. So immediately when I cleared it, I pulled my ripcord, and out it came. So I'm floating down, and I'm wondering, we're only 3 miles over enemy territory. Is it possible that I can land on our side? But unfortunately, no. I hit the ground like a sack of potatoes. That was my first and last parachute jump. And I hit the ground, and it almost knocked the breath out of me, and it put my hips up to my shoulders. And the next thing I looked over, the wind was pulling me on the ground. The wind was blowing, pulling me with my parachute. So I looked over about 10, 20 feet, and there's this soldier there, and he's pointing at his weapon and pointing at me. And what he was asking, was I armed? Because a lot of us gunners would carry 45s. On the missions, we would check out a 45, because if you were shot down over the cities and the civilians got you, they hung you with your parachute, or they tied you up with the parachute and threw you in the fire. So this one buddy of mine, we met after the war was over in our POW organization. He said he had two 45s. And he was going to take a lot of the people with him and save the last one for himself. So I didn't have the 45. I saw no need for one. So he pointed at that and pointed at me, and I shook my head, and he come running up. And he says, "Just a minute, I'll help you out of your chute." So I looked up. I said, maybe I did land on the right side. But when I looked up, I saw that square helmet. Then he said, "For you, the war is over." Then another German came, and he gathered up my chute. And I turned around to the first one. I said, "That's my souvenir to him," as if I had anything to say. And so they gathered up my chute. And then our side was shelling the Germans. So he led us to a oversized, I call it a foxhole. Well, it was sort of a command post dug down in the ground. There was a German officer down in there and about four or five German soldiers. So he had to climb down. He led me there. And I started climbing down the ladder, and there was my right waist gun. And I looked at him, and all his face is all scratched up. I said, "Well, what happened to you?" He says he doesn't remember, because when he pulled his chute, he was in a position where he was down, and when the pilot chute comes out, it's spring-loaded, it knocked him out. So when he hit the ground, and of course the wind was dragging him on the ground, and his face is all scratched up. I was bleeding in several places, because when I left the plane, left out of that hole, it was jaggered. The tail was about to break off. So I was bleeding. So one of the German soldiers went to a first aid kit, and he got some stuff, and he dressed up my wound. Then he turned around to my right waist gunner and said, he pointed my wound and pointed at him. And he said, "Yeah." And he pointed to his head like he had an accessorin headache. So they went back into the kit, and they came up with a white pill. So they gave it to Harvey the Frenchman. Boy, did he like his alcohol. From Louisiana. So he looks at that pill, and he looks at me, and he looks at the pill, and he looks at me. And I tell him, "Harvey," I says, "it's just probably an aspirin." I said, "If they wanted to kill you, they'd have killed you before they brought you in here." So that's what it was. So after the shelling had stopped, they told us, "Come on," they took us out. "They're going to take us into town." So as we were walking, another German soldier comes up and he says, "Come and see here, see if you would recognize one of your comrades." So we went, Harvey and I went over there, and it was a bombardier, and he was finished. He had his harness, but he didn't have a chute, I don't know. And his eyes were popped open, and he had a hole in the top of his head, and blood was trickling out. He was finished. So we just looked, and there was nothing we could do. So then they led us away. They took us into town, and they put us on a truck taking us into town. And all the time, I'm hoping that our side will start an advancement, and maybe we'll get liberated. But nowhere, as we are being transported to town, there was a whole company of American infantry that had just been captured, maybe 100 of them. I said, "Uh-oh, there goes our liberation." So they took us into this building, put us in this building. There was another group of infantrymen that were in this building. There must have been 50, 75 of them. So we came in, and one of the guys come over and says, "What happened to you guys?" I said, "Well, we just got shot down." So they came, and he says, "Oh, Sergeant," he says, you want something to drink? You want something to eat? You want a cigarette?" And I felt so guilty, you know, here, we're prisoners, and they're catering to us. And I told him, "No thanks, no thanks." So we was in that building, maybe about a half hour, and some German officer comes and he motions to me. He says, "Come and see here." So I followed him outside. He says, "Look, look at what your bombers have done. Everything is all destroyed. The buildings were destroyed and everything." And I saw he didn't have a sense of humor. I was going to tell him, "Good shot." But I just looked and shrugged my shoulders and went back into the building.
Okay, hold on. Okay, do you have any other information about the flight, the last flight that you took, Mission 35?
Well, Mission 35. Yeah, let me go back a few missions before that. The word came out from headquarters they wanted to take all our tracers away from us. They said, because we were using the tracers instead of the sights. Well, the sights were no good anyway. They were ring and bead sights. And how are you going to get a target, and they're moving out there like a bunch of mosquitoes, and you're shooting? So we had to take all our tracers out of our belt of ammunition, the 50 calibers. So I had quite a few of the tracers, and I was supposed to turn them into the stockroom. I said, "Nope." I said, "I'm going to save these for a hot mission." So we had this one mission. We had a lot of fighters. So I forgot about my traces, and this fighter was coming in. He was coming in, 9 o'clock level, coming in. And finally I turned loose, and all of a sudden there was a red line come out of my gun. That was all the traces. And, you know, that fighter plane, I don't know whether he saw it or not, but he veered away. He probably thought I had a laser gun or something. It's one red line. So that was one of the so-called comical things that happened. And then, of course, the day I shot down, I was one of the lucky four to get out of the airplane. The other six didn't make it out. The pilot, the co-pilot, of course, the bombardier was the only one I saw. And there was the radio gunner, the ball gunner, and the tail gunner. Six of them didn't make it out, so I was one of the lucky four. And our top turret gunner, he showed up in camp 9 months later, and we asked him, "Where have you been?" Because Harvey and I were asking, how many got out? And no one ever showed up. So finally, about 9 months later, he came into camp. We said, "Where have you been?" So he told us the story of where he'd been, that the Germans took him out of the wreckage of the airplane. And only thing I could think of, right after I got out and I was coming down on my parachute, I saw pieces of the airplane coming down, bypassing me. And that part of the cockpit, you know, the top turret gun is right behind the pilot and co-pilot. And that part of the aircraft probably separated from everything else, and there was enough wing there where it sort of cushioned his fall. But they took him out, they put him in the hospital, and he had a lapse of memory. And he said, "Believe it or not," he said, "I got German blood in me." They gave him a blood transfusion because he was pretty well banged up. And they started working on his mind. They told him everything about his life, where he was from, where he graduated, when he got into the Air Force, when he went overseas, when he joined the outfit, everything. And he said, and the German doctors kept going, until finally he was well enough and they sent him into PW camp. That was quite a thing to see him come back, and he's like someone from the dead. Well, anyway, to continue on with my story, let me see, where was it? Oh, as they were leading us away from the front lines, then they put us into some building, just Harvey and I, and they gave us a piece of black bread, said, "This is your supper," and a knife that wouldn't even cut hot butter. So Harvey and I looked at that and tried to cut that thing, and there's an art in cutting that black bread. You can't just slice it. You got to cut around and around and around. We looked at it and we sort of cast it aside. We didn't know that was going to be our diet for 14 months. And it did taste pretty good before the 14 months was over. So then they transported us, put us on a train with a couple guards, and there was a couple of other crew members from another plane that was shot down. So there was four POWs and two guards. And they were having a ball. They were glad to be away from the Russian front. And so we had a stop at one place to change trains. So they took us into the beer garden, and the beer garden, big, huge, typical German beer garden, and everybody was in there, and then the lights were on, and everybody's talking and having a good time. And then, of course, the waitress came over, and the guards motioned, two beers. So there was about halfway through their beer, and everything in that beer garden got quiet. You could drop a pin, and finally the guards laid the beer down. "Come on, we got to leave." So we got outside. He could speak enough English. He said, the people found out we were airmen, and they were very disturbed that we were in their beer garden, and they was afraid that they would overcome them and take us. So they took us to the roundhouse. That's where the train guy, you know, the guy on the ground switches the tracks and everything. So we had another 5 or 6 hours, and it was cold. So the four of us slept around that belly stove and went to sleep, and finally they woke us up and says, time to go. So we got into Frankfurt, and that's where I got interrogated. Interrogation, the German officer told me more about my outfit than I knew, because our insignia on the tail was a V for victory with the Morse code, dot, 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 dash. I think that's a Morse code for V. Is it?
Di-di-di-da.
So he gets a big book. He had a big, thick book. I guess it's an inch and a half thick, and he files through. Then he opens it up and turns it over to me, and he says, do you know this crew? He could speak pretty good English. And I looked, and I remember this is the first crew that got shot down in the 49 squadron. I heard the guys talking about it, and I knew the name, Kip Patrick. And I looked, and I said, no, who are they? And he says, well, you should know them. He says, they were in your group. I said, well, I said, there's a lot of guys in my group or squadron I don't know. So then he asked me, he says, what is Captain? I forgot his name. He was our interrogation officer. After we get back from a mission, we would get interrogated. You know, how was the weather? How did the bombs hit? What was the opposition, the Luftwaffe, the fighter planes, the flak and everything? And this is what his job was. So he mentioned his name, and I looked at him, and I said, well, who is he? He says, well, I said, the only thing I know about him, I says, I see him in the mess hall. So he looked at me, and he's getting kind of disgusted. So he says, how many runways do you have, 1 or 2? We had 2. I told him 1. He says, what are they, revetments, sand, or concrete? Well, they were revetment. That's that metal thing that ties together. And I told him concrete. And he turned around to me, and he says, you know, if you don't tell me these answers correctly, you're going to be questioned to hell later on. I says, I'm telling you the best of my ability. I was lying. It was one of the few times I ever lied in my life. So after about a half hour, I got dismissed, and he called the right waist gunner in there. So we stayed there maybe a couple of days. Then they put us on 48s, stuffed in there like sardines. And then, of course, we bombed during the day. The British bombed during the night. And anytime there's a train, there's always fighters coming down and stracing the train or bombing the marshalling yards, which is the rail centers. So we went through a couple of those raids, you know, and we were locked in the boxcars, and the guards would run for protection and leave us in the boxcars, and luckily we never got hit by bombs. But that was one of the few nice train rides. We finally got up into Stellagluf 6, which was up there by the three Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, and the other one. I can't remember.
Estonia,
yes. I guess it was up in East Prussia. So after about 6 months there, of course, the time there wasn't too good. We had this one, we had German guards constantly going through the area and into the barracks and making sure that no holes are being bugged and to tunnel out of the compound. We had this one guy, Ham Hands we call him. He was about 7 feet tall, and he had hands, the biggest hands I've ever seen. It looked something like ham. That's why they call him Ham Hands, and he abused us. For no reason or other, he'll come to a POW, and he would either kick him or slap him across the face or push him, doing something like that. Well, in the end, towards the end, they found him with his head off. Somebody took care of him. Well, anyway, we were there for 6 months, and the Russians were coming, so they didn't want us to be liberated by the Russians, and they put us back on boxcar. No, not boxcars, and then loaded us on a on a coal ship that transported coals, and there was two decks in it, and the main part of the deck was covered over, and the only way we could get down in there was each individual climbing down the ladder, and there was about 2,000 of us on board, and each one of us climbing down individually, and there was the deck lowered, and then there was another deck up above that. There was about 2,000 of us on board, and one guy, one POW, he knew what he was getting into, so he ran and he jumped overboard, thinking he could get away from him, and the Germans picked him off. He didn't make it. So he was on that ship, he was in the Baltics, 3 days or 4 days, and the Baltic was mine, and of course our ships, our aircraft, the British, if they ever see a ship out there, they always try to take care of it, send it to the bottom. There was no marking on the ship, there was POWs on board. And we was only there 3 or 4 days, and it was rough weather, and it was dark, and there was no sanitation to speak of, and it was hot then. This was in the month of July. So for sanitation, they would send a bucket down, and then they'd take it back up when they got filled, and then for water, they send the same bucket down with water. So after about 3 or 4 days, we finally landed at the Port of Stettin, and they put foot cuffs on us, two of us together, cuffs around one of our feet, and there was chain and cuffed to another person, two prisoners together. And we got off, we got in the boxcars, and then they took our shoes away from us. And I guess we traveled maybe a day, I'm trying to guess now, maybe a day. And finally, early in the morning, there was this screaming, this German screaming. So the guards, they jumped up and they opened the doors. Of course, the sliding doors are always locked. We could never get out. Our sanitation was in the boxcars. They opened the doors and there's this German in a command open-air command car running up and down where the train was parked with all the POWs on the train screaming at these guards to get us moving. Rausmit, Rausmit, Rausmit. And the more he screamed at the top of his voice. The more excited they got, then we had the Kriegsmarine. The Kriegsmarine were the teenagers. And they had rifles with bayonets. So we finally got out, and we had to dig for our shoes in a big pile. We finally got our shoes. In the meantime, this German commander, he's screaming at the top of his voice. And every time he'd scream, the guards and the Kriegsmarine would all get excited, and they started picking at us with the bayonet. And finally, we got our stuff. We got into our line. And they were going to run us to the camp. So we started running. And some of the guys, and of course, we're chained to each other. And some way or another, we got something, and we managed to unlock the cuffs. So I was unlocked from my buddy. And I had one bag where I had some of our personal belongings and then some of the food that we saved. You know, we never ate everything, or we saved. And I had that, and they started running us. The camp was up, I guess, a good mile away. So they're running us, and the ones that would lag behind, the Kriegsmarine would stick them with the bayonets, and some guys just couldn't make it anymore, and they just lie on the side and lying on the side of the road, and the Kriegsmarine would get at them with the bayonets. And one time one of them got close to me, and when he did, man, I don't know where I got the energy, but I put it in afterburners, and I caught up with the formation. We finally got into camp. They took everything away we had from us, and they gave us the usual search, our body search, make sure we didn't have things that weren't supposed to be. And they put us into the barracks, and we found out later on this commander had a grudge against airmen because his family was killed, unfortunately was killed in bombing. So we stayed there another 6 months, and at night the Russians would come. We had a secret radio. The Germans were never able to find that radio. And we would get the news from this special committee. We had committees in there, escape committee, if you wanted to escape, the news committee, the health committee. So the news committee, they managed to get parts. They bribed the German guards because they liked, we got Red Cross parcels, and we didn't get what we were supposed to, but they had cigarettes, American cigarettes, which they loved, the Germans loved, and we had the D-bars, which they liked to take home to their children. So we had a special committee that dealt with the guards, and they told us don't deal with them individually because then we know what we can get with how many cigarettes and D-bars we have to give them. So with this, they were able to make this crystal radio and get the news from the BBC. So they would give us the true news. And of course, the Germans, we'd had a bulletin board, and the Germans had put their news there, and they never retreated. They always took up new positions. So this is the thing we lived on, was hope, because we certainly didn't live on the food. The food was insufficient. We didn't have to work because the Germans were part of the Geneva Convention, and non-commissioned officers did not have to work unless they volunteered. And that part they did honor, because what we did with the German soldiers, we sent them back to the States, and they lived in our barracks, and they ate the same food that we did under the Geneva Convention. POW is supposed to be food-wise and treated the same as their soldiers. Well, the Germans kind of looked aside on that. But the German soldiers that were in the States got royal treatment. So after we got settled in the barracks, our representatives asked to see the commanding officer, and he says, you know, you're not treating us according to the Geneva Convention. He says, as far as I'm concerned, the Geneva Convention is a piece of paper. I'll do this camp like I want. So it was pretty bad. There was ham hands in there, too. So then we heard that the Russians were approaching, and then at night we could hear the guns. So good, we're going to be liberated by the Russians. But the Germans knew that too. So we're going to move again. They told us, we're going to move you out, and we're going to move you to the closest railroad, and then you'll be transported to the next camp. But they didn't tell us that that railroad was over 2 months away and over 300 miles that we walked in the dead of winter. And this was Europe's worst winter in 25 years. So we got on there, and the German guards are marching along, right along with us. But every hour, we would rest for 10 minutes. And we had a couple of British doctors were in our group. And I got a chance to speak to the doctor, and I said, have you ever seen human beings treated this way? He says, no. He says, I just don't see how you survive. I said, well, the only way I'm surviving, I'm living on hope that one day I will be liberated. And the worst our treatment gets, that's getting closer to Liberation Day. So after 2 months and over 300 miles, we ended up at Falling Basel. Now, this was we left Stalag-Luft 6 up there in East Prussia around July of 44. So we got to Stalag-Luft 4. We got there the month of July until February of 45. So in February of 45 is when we marched out of camp, and we finally got to Falling Basel. It was sometime in late May or April. It was 2 months, February, March, April. Yeah, about the end of April and 1st of March. And then when they got us there, we were closer to the Allies than we were to the Russians, because the Allies had, our troops had crossed the Rhine. So now they're in German territory. So after a few days there, the word came out, they're going to march us back west again. So our doctors, the two British doctors says these troops are not capable of going on the road again. Said, well, we got orders to take them out. So the doctor finally got the German commander to agree to leave the sick behind. So he had to interview him. So there I was, my feet, my nerves had been shot because walking over that frozen ground, it affected my nerves, and it's affected to this day. And I went to the doctor, and he said, no, there's others worse than you, and if we have too many leave behind, he said, they're going to take the whole bunch of us. So there was one tent that all the sick were going. So I was in the formation marching out, and I looked around. There was no German guards close by, and I made a run for the tent. I went into the tent, and two of my buddies followed me. And that bunch marched out, went out west again. And after the war was over, I visited one of my friends that was in that march. I said, what happened to you after you marched out? He said, well, believe it or not, said, we're in formation. They're marching us. And he says, two of our fighter planes, all they could see was a formation of soldiers, and they came down and strafed us. Some of the guys got killed. Some of them got wounded. And finally, they went out into this open field and made the sign POW, because the fighter planes were going to make another pass. So when they saw that POW, they came over, wiggled their wings, and went on. So it, there we were, you know, and of course we had the radio. The Germans were never able to find that radio. So we heard about the invasion in June of 44. I said, well, it won't be long now. Then we heard about Patton. He's my ideal. How he was going through Germany until Eisenhower stopped him. Said, we're going to be liberated by Christmas. But unfortunately, the Battle of the Bulge came out. So finally, how much?
So you slipped into this tent with all the other sick people. What did you do after that?
Well, they moved out, and of course the guards that were left, it must have been guards from World War One, and they had rifles of World War One. So we found out some of the guys were cutting their way out, going to the farms and getting food. There was no food, nothing around. And so that's what my buddy and I did. I went out this hole, and this German came, this senior citizen came, and he's saying, Rasmus, pointed us to get back in. No. So then he gets mad. He takes his rifle off his shoulder, and he slams it on the ground. And I look at him, and I said, look, old man. I says, you wouldn't shoot us. I said, the war is about over. So we walked away, and he was still screaming for us to come back. So anyway, the word passed out that Hitler wanted all POWs executed, but his officers had better sense than that. So then several days later, some guy comes running into the building where we were. He says, all the guard towers are empty. And that's when we started slipping out of the thing. And about then, of course, in the radio, we knew Montgomery's outfit. I think they call them the Desert Rats. They were from North Africa. They're the one of them that helped to push the Germans out of North Africa, with Patton on the other side. And let me see where I've lost track.
Okay, go ahead, continue.
Okay, so we went to the farm to look for something to eat, and one guy came out, he was a civilian, I don't know why he wasn't in uniform, in good English, he said, what do you guys want? He said, we're from the PW camp, we're looking for something to eat. He said, I have nothing left. He says, everybody clean me out. Well, anyway, we went back to the camp, and about 2 days later, we knew Montgomery was getting close and close. So after, there was one morning, it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, two armored cars come pulling up to the camp, to the gate, with the star, the white star. Oh, man, a dream come true. So the captain got out, he was British. He said, I'd like to speak to your representative. They went into the office, and what they were going to do, and arranged, they were in there for about an hour, and they came out. He said, well, we're going to get food to you immediately. We're going to take you out of here immediately, and we're going to take the very sick first, and then we'll go through the line. So I was pretty well, I guess I was down less than 100 pounds. So about the second or third day, my name was called, so it was going to be taken out. What clothes we had, they took away from us because they were loaded with lice, and they put them in a pile, and they burned them, and they gave us British uniforms, and we traveled all that day by truck. That night, we stayed in an abandoned factory. They had breakfast in the morning. Then the next day, they took us to the airport. We boarded on a C-46 and took us to Oxford, England. So we got to Oxford, England, and they turned us over to... And of course, when they took our clothes away from us and gave us the British uniform, they doused us with DDT, just like powder, in our hair, all through our body and everything. So when we landed at the airport there at Oxford, they turned us over to the American authorities, and they doused us again, and then the Americans came with the truck and took us to the hospital, and the hospital was Quinston Huts, and here... I was able to sleep between white sheets again and a blanket. In the morning, there was music over the sound system and the cafeteria and beautiful American nurses. So we go in the morning, I go to the cafeteria to eat and, of course, see all that food, you know, and I want to eat it all. All I could eat was just a spoonful. But I got classified as severe malnutrition. So it's, we were there. I'm going to cut a lot of my events short. So finally, we got word that we're going to get on a ship and go back to the USA. And the military said, don't let any ship come back empty. Well, whoever's got to come back, especially the POW, put them on board. We're going to take them back. So that was a nice trip back, and I finally landed in Norfolk, Virginia, and I get on U.S. soil again, and I says, oh, terrific. God bless America. And, you know, I've got to tell you about a dream I had. A dream I had was that I was on a ship coming back to the States, and the ship was docking, and I was leaning on the rail looking at the people down there, and there was this beautiful mist down there on the dock, and she was looking like she was looking for someone. Now, this is in my dream, and I looked at her, and I says, wow, what a beautiful mist to come back to. So time came to deboard. I was deboarding, and I hit the ground, and this beautiful miss came up to me, put her arms around me, and kissed me, says, darling, you're back. Wow. And don't you know, when that ship was docking, I was looking, but she wasn't there. But there were many other events that happened, but once I got back on U.S. soil, we got into the building there, and the Red Cross had a bank of phones. It says, call whoever you want, wherever they are. So I called my mom and dad. I said, Mom, I'm back in the good old USA again. I said, God bless America. So we got, then they gave us our furlough papers and gave us 90-day furlough. It was good to be back.
Well, Larry, this is a fantastic interview, but let me ask you just a few questions. One of them is that, what did the military service do for you? And the other question is, how did you get to Nassau County?
How did I get to where?
To Nassau County.
Nassau County? Oh, yeah. What did the military do? Well, you know, at first, they didn't recognize POWs. They never put it in our discharge. The only recognition we got as POWs is when the Vietnam POWs returned. Then the VA started a program of, they call it mental health for POWs, that we would go in there and restash the things that we went through. And I told one of the counselors, or she was a psychiatrist, I says, you know, that doesn't do me very good to bring back all these memories like this. She says, what are you doing here then? I says, I'm here because I'm with other POWs. I says, that makes me feel so good.
And so, how did you end up in Nassau County?
Nassau County, well, our children, we're getting up in age. I four girls and one son, they all dissipated. So it was just Jean and I, my wife. So the children got to be concerned. What is going to happen to you two if one of you pass away? What's going to happen to the other? Says, why don't you move up here? So there was a house that was for sale next door. But in the meantime, Jean had gotten sick over prescription medication that messed up her liver. She was taking Lipitor and Crestor, and it sent her liver almost to a liver transplant. So here we already made plans to go, and we already put the house up for sale, and I went around the neighborhood seeing if anybody would like to buy our house. And in the meantime, Jean is getting treatment by doctors, going lab for tests, you know, what is wrong. She turned jaundiced and everything. And the house is all packed, and one way or another, we managed to get through all that. And, of course, Connie left her five children at home and drove down. And Skip, our son, who is in Marietta, Georgia, and he's with Electronic Outfit, he came down to help us move. And Connie helped us to move. And our other daughters helped us to move. So without the help of our children, I don't think we would have ever been able to do it. And this is how we ended up at Nassau County.
Well, thank you very much. This concludes the interview. Thank you for sharing your recollections for me and for the benefit of the nation. This concludes the interview of Lawrence Carrastro.
Well, thank you. I'd like to say one thing about our children. Without them, we'd have never made it. We'd never been able to make it. Especially
you
Connie.
Wouldn't have been here.